Something had gone wrong, Ruckerman knew, but he could not guess what. The increased military presence on the Huddersfield campus had been inescapable, however. In spite of the chill in the little storage room, he had perspired heavily, a fact noted by his unresponsive guard. Everything had been going so well. Velcourt's plan to get him into Huddersfield had worked, and not even Sadler had suspected the real reason. Only Turkwood had smelled something wrong and had tried a typical Turkwood response. Ruckerman thought about their arrival in England. McCrae had grinned at him in the small jet's cockpit, bringing the plane around in a tight circle over the lake above Aberfeldy in Scotland. "You are about to see an artist at work," he said. "Why can't we find an airport above the—" "Look up there." McCrae hooked a thumb at the barrier command jet circling high above them. "This is an emergency. If we suddenly go hunting around for another place to set down, they're going to smell mousy. You can bet they have orders to shoot at the slightest suspicion that all is not kosher here. That lake looks awfully small." Ruckerman stared ahead of them at the approaching water. A low mist curled above it. "The trick is to set us down at precisely the right spot," McCrae said. "We'll skim a bit, but not much." Gently, bucking slightly as it hung on the edge of a stall, the plane dipped down into the valley at the end of the lake and leveled off. Ruckerman gripped the edge of his seat with both hands. McCrae was going to kill them. Those hills at the far end of the lake were too close. McCrae was talking as much to himself as to Ruckerman. Nose up a little. He pulled the wheel toward his chest. A little more. Ruckerman stared in terror at the hills looming higher and higher ahead of them. There wasn't room to do this. He started to shout a protest when the tail touched water. He felt it slap, then the nose came down sharply in a shuddering, bucking screech of protesting metal that threw him against his safety harness. Solid water covered the windscreen in front of him, hiding his view of the shore. Something grated and rasped under the nose. Water cascaded off the windscreen. The nose came up and the plane stopped. Ruckerman saw a thin line of leafless trees directly in front of him, a field with sheep cropping the grass beyond. "Yahoo!" McCrae's mouth opened wide in a shout of joy. He said something else, but it was lost in the thunder of three barrier command jets screaming past close above them. Ruckerman felt deafened by the sound. He was a moment recovering, then something gurgled and creaked behind him. "Look at that, will you?" McCrae demanded. "The nose is on dry land." McCrae popped the cockpit's emergency exit and swung away a triangular section of windscreen beside him. He unharnessed and stood on his seat with his head outside to peer around them. "Let's get our asses out of here," he said. He stepped over the edge of the cockpit and slid down the plane's side to a pebbled shingle with spiky reeds growing through it. Presently, Ruckerman leaned out above him. "What about our bags?" Ruckerman asked. "If there's a bomb," McCrae said. He shook his head. "Better get out and wait a bit." Ruckerman frowned. "Probably no bomb at all. Just a grandstand play by this young jerk." Ducking back into the plane, Ruckerman made his way to the rear, wading through water over his ankles. He retrieved his bag and McCrae's lashed in the seat behind it, then returned to the emergency exit where he tossed both bags to McCrae. "Come on," McCrae said. "Get out of there!" Moving slowly to emphasize his disdain, Ruckerman followed McCrae's path to the ground. There he took his bag and followed the pilot up the pebble shingle toward the trees. "That was a damn fool, harebrained thing to do," Ruckerman said. "There was no—" He was interrupted by a thumping explosion at the plane behind them. Both men whirled at the sound. The plane's left wing had been cut away along a jagged line near the fuselage. The severed portion of the wing had been driven sideways about 6 meters and lay upended in the reeds. "One thing you can say for Turkwood," McCrae said. "He's neat." Ruckerman stared at the scene in gape-jawed horror. My God! What if that had happened in the air? He was still staring at the plane when a Land Rover came growling over the hill above them and sped down to the lake. We have visitors, McCrae said. As he stared at the military guard in the little storage room opposite Hupp's lab, Ruckerman thought about poor McCrae. The English were adamant about not sending him to Ireland. We've no facilities for holiday jaunts, the regional commander had said as he arranged Ruckerman's transportation to Huddersfield. Poor McCrae had been shunted off to something called the Holding Center for Foreign Nationals. Someone rapped on the storage room door. Ruckerman's guard opened the door. Someone outside said, "Bring him." Ruckerman found himself presently standing beside Hupp. Stonar regarded them both as though they had been scraped off with slime from the underside of a damp rock. Ruckerman, who had met with Stonar only briefly at one of the latter's regular inspections, knew he was in the presence of authority, and now could complain. "What is the meaning of this?" Ruckerman demanded. "Do you realize who I am?" "You're a spy," Stonar said. "We've been known to shoot spies." He glanced at Hupp. "The frog here has just told me an interesting story. He will keep his mouth shut now while you answer a few questions." "Fat's in the fire," Ruckerman thought. Well, the president had warned him he was on his own at Huddersfield. The United States government could take no official action to protect him. "We thought your recent report to President Velcor rather interesting," Stoner said. "Beckett and his team are going to do some amazing things." "What amazing things?" "They're very close to a complete description of the plague," Ruckerman said. He cleared his throat. "I resent being called a spy. Everything I've done has been monitored by us," Stoner said. "By amazing, did you mean they will produce a cure?" "How can we tell until we have the complete picture?" Ruckerman asked. Hupp nodded. "Stay out of this, frog," Stoner warned. But Ruckerman now had the clue he needed. Hupp had not let the cat out of the bag, not to this turd. "You are not helping our efforts by this attitude," Ruckerman said. "There is a high likelihood that we will be able to produce a cure, if you will. But you used the word amazing." "The president is impatient," Ruckerman said, "and it's my informed guess that we will succeed. As a scientist, however, I cannot tell you flatly right now that we will be able to nullify the plague. All I can say for sure is that we'll have a complete picture of it quite soon." "How soon?" Ruckerman glanced at Hupp as though to say, "This is too much." Hupp shrugged. "Weeks, perhaps," Ruckerman said, a sigh in his voice. "And maybe only days. We are tracing out an extremely complicated organism for which there is no precedent. It is absolutely new, man-made." "You told your president that you've given Hupp and his team a complete picture." "A complete picture of what?" "I brought with me some new software, a computer search program which has speeded up our efforts remarkably. The president knew I was bringing this. Why didn't you inform us of this immediately?"
"I didn't think you would understand it," Ruckerman said. "I was given to understand that only Beckett's team was sufficiently advanced to employ this software effectively."
"Given to understand? By whom?"
"By Beckett himself, among others."
"And the reports of your spies," Stoner accused.
"Mr. Stoner," Ruckerman said, "the search program is in Huddersfield's computer system where anyone can have access to it. If you wish to examine it, please feel free."
Stoner glared at him. The bastard Ruckerman. He knew computer software was beyond the inspector's competence. Scowling, Stoner stepped to the door and opened it. "Send in General Shiles." Stoner waited to one side of the open door. Presently a brigadier general in a superbly tailored field uniform strode into the room. He nodded once to Stoner. Shiles was a tall, skinny figure, monocle in right eye, swagger stick under left arm. He had weathered skin and a hawk's beak nose above a tight little mouth and square chin. The eyes were pale blue, and the one behind the monocle gave off a glassy sheen.
"You heard the entire conversation, General?" Stoner asked.
Yes, sir. Giles's voice was brusque and clipped. I must be getting back to base immediately, Stoner said. I'll leave you to lay out the conditions to everyone here. You can start with the frog and his friend, the spy.
Very good, sir.
Stoner passed a baleful stare across Hupp and Ruckerman, but did not speak. Turning, Stoner left the room. A uniformed hand reached in from outside and closed the door.
I have a full brigade, plus the original guards in position around this establishment, Shiles said, speaking to a position between Hupp and Ruckerman.
No one from here will be permitted to leave. No more going down to the village pub of an evening. There will be no outside communication without my personal permission. Do you understand?
Sir, Hupp said. I think I can...
Ruckerman placed a hand over Hupp's mouth and shook his head. Shiles regarded Ruckerman with astonishment. Lifting a notepad and pencil from Hupp's lab table, Ruckerman scribbled a few words and passed the tablet to Shiles. Time for the carrot, Ruckerman thought. The stick sure as hell would not work with this man. Shiles gave him a momentary cold appraisal before taking the tablet and reading what Ruckerman had written. The monocle dropped out of Shiles's eye. He replaced it before finding the pencil and writing beneath Ruckerman's message, "How can this be?" Ruckerman took the next page in the tablet and wrote, "What we have discovered leaves no other conclusion." Shiles glanced at the door through which Stoner had gone, then at Ruckerman. Ruckerman shook his head, took the tablet and wrote, "He can deliver death. We can deliver life." General Shiles tore off the used pages of the tablet and stuffed them into a side pocket. He tapped his left thigh with his swagger stick. Ruckerman could see decision forming in the man. That was a rich carrot displayed on the pages of the tablet. A long, long life and perfect health. And Shiles was a man to believe in scientists. Were they not the ones who had given him atom bombs and rockets? He must know this prize was worth the gamble. He would want to control it.
"Damn," Shiles said. "It would appear I've been given charge over the golden egg."
"Remember what happened when the farmer killed the goose," Hupp said. "You're quite bright for a frog," Shiles said. "Just don't forget that I'm the farmer."
"I presume you will use discretion," Ruckerman said.
"Indeed," Shiles said.
"I will leave you two to your scientific devices now. I trust you'll explain the new rules to your teammates. Leave Wycombe Finch to me."
Ruckerman waved a cautionary finger.
"Yes, quite," Shiles said.
"The fewer who know, the better."
Turning on one heel, he strode to the door, flung it open, and left them. Hupp heard heels clicking outside and imagined the snappy salutes. The British were very good at snappy salutes.
"It could be worse," Ruckerman said.
Hupp nodded agreement. Ruckerman had been right to silence him. There were listeners behind every wall, and Ruckerman was correct to bring Shiles into the picture. There was plenty of power to go around. Shiles had the look of a man who enjoyed power. The more power, the better. "Wycombe Finch is off the hook, and we're on it," Ruckerman said.
"Perhaps our greatest crime was this devotion to violent fanaticism. It led us to kill off or otherwise silence moderation. We destroyed our moderates, that's what we did. And look what it brought us."
Finton Craig Doheny. John took an instant dislike to Adrian Peard at the Killaloe facility. The man was all decked out in Lovett green tweeds, standing at the entrance to greet the new arrivals. He was a caricature of the great seigneur, that brown face under the courtyard's intense lighting. The lab had been visible in the fading light as John's armored car had come down out of the hills. It was not actually at Killaloe, their driver had explained, but farther north. The name was a deliberate bit of confusion, which they were not to expose. The facility was a large stone building that once had been a castle. The daub-gray stone lay within the crooked arm of a hill like a malignant growth that had extruded several feelers toward the nearby lakeshore.
"It doesn't belong there."
"That's what you're thinking," the driver had said.
"Everyone thinks that. but it's better inside. From the inside you cannot see the place.
Welcome to the Killaloe facility, Peard said after introducing himself. His handshake was dry and perfunctory. Your fame has preceded you, Dr. O'Donnell. We're all quite excited.
John felt anger. Doheny had made good his threat to create a John O'Donnell myth. Father Michael and the boy were assigned a guide and directed to the other wing. The priest avoided John's eyes as he left. Father Michael had been silent and withdrawn ever since John's confession. O'Neill within had ceased howling, though, and John felt somewhat calmer. Confession had helped. The mental confusion that had followed confession lay in a walled-off limbo. All John wanted now was food and rest, a time to think.
"We've laid on a small meeting of top stuff," Peard said. "Hope you feel up to it. Time presses."
John blinked at him, anger suspended in fatigue. Peard thought the man looked tired and confused, but Doheny had said to give no time to reflect, keep him off balance. Still, this was supposed to be O'Neill. The courtyard air smelled of lake dampness and mildew, with overtones of exhaust fumes from the departed armored cars. John was glad to leave it. Peard escorted him inside the great double doors, all the time keeping up a bright patter of conversation. They went down a long hall, many doors, some standing open with people visible inside at various occupations. Computer terminals, a centrifuge whirling, the hiss of steam from a sterilizer. John recognized blue laser light in one room. The impression was of well-intentioned but largely senseless industry. There was much bustling about, intent examination of culture dishes and test tubes, and even an electron microscope. The hum of a powerful electric motor came from behind one closed door. There was a curved stairway at the far end of the hall. It took them up to a landing where Peard flung open a heavy oak door and escorted John into a library. Old portraits lined one wall above bookcases and stacks and a wheeled ladder. A small fireplace of Italian marble with carved cherubs decorated the end of an open space where chairs and one heavy table had been set out. The room smelled of pipe smoke and old books. John found himself being introduced to at least 10 men. He lost count after the third. They were mostly tweeds and turtleneck pullovers, a few cardigans. There was a Jim somebody, a Dr. Balfour, of whom you've heard, of course. When John had shaken the last hand, a freestanding chalkboard was wheeled out from the stacks and placed near the fireplace. Peard gestured at the chalkboard, thinking that his people had behaved quite well. They had been carefully briefed, of course. Their expressions betrayed only anxious curiosity. John stared from the people now seated looking at him to the blank surface of the chalkboard. It had been scrubbed clean, not even a hint of what had been written there before. Empty, dark green surface. What was he supposed to do with it? Abruptly he recalled the penance assigned him by Father Michael. Would that arouse O'Neill within? Doheny says you have a remarkable new approach to the plague, Peard prompted. John reached for the chalk on the ledge below the board. O'Neill within did not object. The hand was a fascinating thing to watch. It moved of itself. His body had taken on another life. Turning to Peard and the others with a calm smile, John spoke in a firm voice. Everyone naturally agrees that a virus must have been used as the specialized structure with which to inject the nucleic acid into the cells of this new bacteria. I assume that the phage approach needs no explanation in this room. Several dry chuckles greeted this. John turned and stared past the chalkboard for a moment, appearing to gather his thoughts. His gaze fell on the fireplace and a portrait above it. An Elizabethan dandy with form-fitting dark coat and lace at the neck and cuffs, cruel eyes, the face of a predatory bird. Synthetic hereditary information was incorporated into the DNA complement of the virus, John said, shifting the chalk from one hand to the other and back. How intently they listened, hanging on every word. There has to be another necessary characteristic of the phage, John said. That the virus in its parasitizing of the new bacteria must possess DNA with only a single chain at its end. An incomplete helix designed to lock into the receptor DNA. It is a complementary message being inserted into the host. I assume that the synthetic DNA must adhere to the viral DNA in such a way that it causes the virus to manufacture more of the desired form. What a remarkable thing his voice was, John thought. It went on almost of itself, steady and informative. Heads were nodding agreement all around him. But what if the phage were created with more than a single dangling chain? John asked. Certain human cells have receptors for testosterone, for example. Females have estrogen receptors. There are many similar receptor sites. There also must be a message pattern that determines whether the fetus will be either male or female. The pattern will be different for each sex. The nucleic acid blueprint that directs the creation of proteins must possess a shaping force that can direct substances into locked positions. He turned to the chalkboard and watched that remarkable self-directing hand sketch a series of three-letter combinations. UCU, UCC, UCA, UCG, GGU, GGC, GGA, GGG, GCU, GCC, GCA, GCG. He watched the hand at its work until it stopped after completing five rows of the triplet series. Then it went back and added identifying labels opposite each series. Ser, Gly, Alla, Thr, Pro. A pipe smoker in a hand-knit blue pullover at John's left gestured at the board with his pipe stem.
"It's incomplete," he said.
"Incomplete series." "I'll give you the rest of it presently," John said. "I want you to think in groups of five. Order is important, as you indicate. But the choice of five, I believe, is essential. The transmission code is broken into groups of five, allocations being matched to the available chemical bonds at the receptor sites."
"Those sex-determining sites you postulate?" the pipe smoker asked.
"Yes. I ask you to imagine flagella. The fibers in a single chain, and incomplete, reaching out and locking into living receptors. A pentaplug, you might say, designed for a specific receptacle. It can only be plugged in at a particular site. But when it is plugged in, it will not drop out." Peard's staff hitched chairs closer, peering up at John.
"Why five?"
someone asked. "Each of these quadratic stacks," John gestured at the series he had written on the board, "has an open end, a fifth segment that can be allocated as you wish. You shape it to fit."
"Good God,"
the pipe smoker said. He gave John a look of awe.
"Shuts off the living process. How did you hit on it?"
"The simplest required form," John said. "Given the plague's symptoms," Peard offered.
"How do you determine the side groups?" someone demanded.
"Between the DNA and the RNA, the only chemical difference is the fourth base. Thymine for one and uracil for the other," John said. "The different sequences can be determined by comparing the FD mass spectrums, using stereoisomers, of course. The different shapes of the DNA helixes will tell us the submolecular shapes within them."
"You're saying Crick's central dogma is not true," Peard said.
John nodded. Peard had a quick mind, anyway. He obviously had leaped ahead to the implications in what had already been revealed. Questions began to bombard John from all sides.
"More than one amino acid substitution? Of the peptide bond?"
"Yes.
The carboxyl group and the amino group. But doesn't it have to be a high polymer? Wouldn't the phage disintegrate?"
Peard jumped to his feet and waved a hand for silence. "There has to be feedback from the cytoplasm," John said, "just as Dr. Peard suggests." John put the chalk on its ledge and rubbed a hand across his brow, closing his eyes. He had the beginnings of a headache, and his shoulders trembled with fatigue. Peard touched John's arm.
Long drive, eh? I'd say a bit of food and rest are indicated.
John nodded.
Fits, damn it, someone said. Makes all sorts of sense.
We'll meet again tomorrow after Dr. O'Donnell has rested, Peard said. John allowed himself to be led off by Peard. He could still hear the people talking in the library, excited voices, some arguments. Was Doheny right, after all? Did it only take inspiration? But he had given them an accurate briefing. The penance demanded it.
Peard led him into a brightly lighted kitchen where sandwiches and milk were provided by an old man in a white apron. Peard took him then to a small bedroom with its own bath. A single window looked out across the moon-bathed loch. John heard the door close and the snick of a bolt. He tested the door. Locked. He extinguished the room's lights and returned to the window. There was a stone-enclosed cattle boulie next to the lake, boggy ground with high reeds beyond the enclosure.
I'm a prisoner, he thought.
Doheny's doing. He let fatigue rise up within him as he watched the moonlight pour across the loch and the bogs. What did it matter if he was a prisoner? The moonlight out there was a haunted thing, he thought, the light out of lovers past pouring itself away where no love could be. Bits and pieces of the long ride to this place tugged at his awareness. They had driven interminably in the long twilight, a timeless, droning eternity. When O'Neill's howling had ceased, he had felt the removal of a weight. The steel slit in the side of the armored car had framed a view of a hilltop bathed in orange sunset. Remnant black shadows up there where an ancient ring fort, a wrath, had stood. That had been a place of life, he thought. Now it was a silent relic. He felt that the occupants of the armored car might fade just as easily into empty relics, bones and rusty metal. The ride was far different from the tramp over the countryside. Sparring with Herity had become almost an instinctive thing in the months of their slow passage. Doing their laundry in running water, digging food out of buried caches, killing feral pigs and cows. What a land it was! John recalled a small stream at his feet, water winding through reeds, the ground boggy along the edges. The current had tipped the reeds in a careless rhythm. Down, up, down, up. It had been movement like their walking feet. There had been freedom in it. Yes, freedom. Their possessions on their backs. An odd feeling. He had been liberated there with Herity, the priest and the boy, experiencing a freedom from the things of the world that perhaps only the migratory hordes of the nomad ages had known. Those people of foot and horse and tents. Not until oxen and carts had possessions begun to subdue that kind of freedom. It was a thought John felt he would have liked to discuss with Gannon. We took only what was useful to a nomad's life. As John stood in the darkness of his room staring at the moonlit loch, he grew aware of movement below him. A dark figure had come out of the shadows on the other side of the original castle ramparts. John recognized Father Michael from the walk. The priest moved aimlessly out to the edge of the paved area and then on to the lawn at the top of the lake. The priest there reminded John of the penance. Help them find a cure. He faced away from the window, turned on the room's lights and undressed for bed. Help them find a cure. Yes, he would have to do it. Father Michael was facing the building when John's light went on. He glimpsed John's profile. The vague movements, saw the light go out. John's confession had left a paradoxical residue in Father Michael, an awful weight and a sense of emptiness. The priest was reminded of the moment when he had bid goodbye to another period in his life, the years when he had occupied a corner house in Dublin's Coombe, serving as spiritual adviser in the Catholic school. He had seen the very house that morning from the armored car when the driver detoured out of the city. The row houses, all sadness, everything gone to weed and empty windows.
The church school had been reduced to a granite ruin, its interior emptied by flames. What he missed most, Father Michael decided, was the boys and girls spewing forth from the school, the noisy romping of their play in that interlude of freedom between classrooms and home. Whenever he closed his eyes and thought about it, Father Michael could summon back their shouts, the loud calls of derision and display, the brief gatherings of faces, the outcries with plans for later, the complaints about chores. Father Michael looked up at John's darkened window, recalling the effect of the silent boy upon that poor man up there. Doheny had constructed that effect with efficient malice. The boy had been a good choice. He represented an essence of something to be seen in the few boys to be glimpsed in this Irish world. None of the old vigor remained. Was it that boys did not make as much rumpus in the absence of girls? There had been a special kind of happiness under all of that noise that Father Michael feared this world would never again experience. It was not just the boys who had lapsed into something reminiscent of those stone-faced houses in the coombe. Each individual ultimately hidden behind a blank exclusion that tried to betray no hint of the griefs concealed within. John's confession changed nothing, Father Michael decided, unless it led the man to right in some small way the terrible wrong that had been done. And what if there is no cure? Father Michael felt that his own thoughts had betrayed him. It was an unprincipled thought, not worthy of him. God could not intend such a thing. This was one more example that the old principles were gone, erased by one man's actions. Father Michael's newly restored faith stumbled. Principles. That was one of those words like responsibility. Such words were private passions exposed, like a corner of yard goods on a shop table, not revealing at all what lay under the stack. Synonyms for things quite different they were. Faith went about disguised as principle. Faith. It was a grab-bag word, one of those little red and black signs bought at a cheap shop. It said, "Keep off the grass." It said, "No trespassing." It said, "Restricted area, authorized personnel only." Father Michael buried his face in his hands. God, what have we done? They had destroyed innocence for all time, he thought. That was what they had done. He realized then that there must have been an innocence about John Roe O'Neill before tragedy shattered him. Not a perfect innocence, because even then O'Neill had played with terrible powers, the sorcerer's apprentice trying an incantation while the master was absent. Was God not in his heaven, then? Was the loss of innocence God's intent? There could be no going back from such a loss. That was the most terrifying thing of all. You could not return to virginity. Father Michael knelt on the wet grass below John's window then, and prayed aloud, God, restore us. God, restore us. God, restore us. Peered, returning from conferring with Doheny, heard the voice from the lakeside and paused in the shadows between the buildings to stare out at the kneeling figure. The moonlight was bright, and Peered recognized Father Flannery. The priest had not yet been told about the little marriage chore in wait for him. Peered debated whether to go out and bring up the subject immediately, but the priest obviously was praying. Peered was of that school which thought of prayer as an extremely personal thing, not to be shared with others. Watching someone pray embarrassed him. Whenever he was in church, he only mouthed the prayers silently, aware of all the listeners around him. "I'll wait until morning," Peered thought. He hurried off to his quarters, his mind full of what had passed between him and Doheny. It had been a fascinating conversation. Doheny had already been in his office, having sped the short route to Killaloe in a fast convoy with motorcycle outriders. He had been on the phone, talking to Wycombe Finch, an oddly one-sided conversation with the Englishman apparently not speaking much. Doheny had written on a pad for Peard to read.
Something's happening over there. Someone's listening to us, and Y is upset by it. I tell you why. The man's personality changed in front of our eyes.
Doheny pointed to Peard and gestured at the TV monitor on the corner of the desk, its camera still focused on the library and the position where John had performed at the blackboard. Doheny's lips formed the words silently, "I watched it." Peard nodded. Wycombe Finch apparently said something non-committal or disagreed with Doheny. The latter scowled at the phone.
"The driver watched in the mirror," Doheny said. "The priest heard his confession, yes. Whatever it was, Father Michael's absolutely crushed by it."
Doheny motioned for Peard to take the chair across the desk from him. Peard obeyed, wondering why Doheny dared share this information with the Englishman. It was dangerous. Anyone could be listening.
"Five, yes," Doheny said.
"He says the base series continues to be divisible by four." Doheny listened for a moment, then,
"What's unnatural about it? We've had it right from the horse's mouth."
Wycombe Finch apparently said something that Doheny found amusing.
"Why should he trick us? Anyway, this is beautifully simple. Five single extensions to the double helix, all set to lock in at the receptor sites. It's quite elegant. I tell you why. The man standing there explaining all this to us knew what the hell he was talking about."
Doheny sounds British when he's talking to Wycombe Finch, Peard thought. He was so damned open about this collaboration.
It does smack of treason.
Doheny listened, rolling his eyes, then,
"Yes, the implications are mind-staggering.
Talk to you later, why?" He replaced the phone in its cradle before looking up at Peard.
"Adrian, have you really considered the kind of tiger we have by the tail?"
"What do you mean?"
"Have you considered where this knowledge may lead?"
"We can put the world back together," Peard said. Doheny aimed a lidded gaze at the shadows beyond Peard.
"Back together? Oh no, Adrian. Humpty Dumpty is broken beyond repair. Whatever we put together, it won't be our old world. That one's gone. Forget it.
2 generations. 3 at the most," Peard said.
"Don't talk stupid, Adrian."
There was anger in Doheny's voice.
"Knowledge has always been power, but never before to this extent. If we're not careful, we may create a world that'll make these plague times seem like a country fair by comparison."
Peard blinked. What did Doheny mean?
The world would be short of women for a time, certainly, but if they cured this plague, many diseases might be erased. A black shadow could be removed from mankind's future.
"I'm for some sleep," Doheny said. "Our guest is all safely tucked away for the night, locked in, and a guard posted."
"If he asks about the lock, tell him I ordered it," Doheny said.
"The guard isn't obvious, is he?"
"All very normal. In mufti, and an excuse for being in the halls."
"There are some restrictions on his movements during the day," Doheny said. "He goes nowhere near the safe tank down there with Kate and Stephen. Somebody has to be with him at all times. Close watch and alert, and keep him on the grounds. Unsafe beyond our perimeters. He'll understand that."
"What about the priest and the boy?"
"No restrictions there.
I want him to run into them frequently." "Is old Moon around?"
Peard glanced at his wristwatch.
"He's in quarters right now. Have him bug O'Neill's room during the day tomorrow."
"You are sure he's O'Neill?"
"Sure as gold in the bank. If he discovers he's being bugged, won't that make him suspicious?"
"Moon knows how to do it. Tell Moon to put a recorder on the bug and let me have the tapes daily."
"You're staying?"
"I'm staying.
You couldn't get me away from here."
Peard's mouth drew into a tight line. He did not like this development. Peard liked his own little empire, his own powers. Doheny's presence diluted those powers.
"I want no slip-ups," Doheny said.
"No repetition of Kevin O'Donnell's stupidities. If this fails, it's on my shoulders."
"That being the case, my orders will be followed to the letter, and I'm staying to see to that."
Peard nodded, finding this to be expected. If it failed, Doheny could only blame himself.
"Am I billeted in the same room?" Doheny asked.
"Yes."
"Come along now," Doheny said.
"Let's get our rest. Tomorrow's a busy day."
"I still have the supply lists to go over," Peard said.
Doheny smiled, but Peard noticed that the smile went no farther than his mouth.
"Very well, then," Doheny said.
He left the room. Peard waited for several minutes before picking up the telephone and placing a call to Dublin. When it was answered, he identified himself and said,
"I think we have Doheny's arse."